Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
Thank you so much. Talking about getting into character, I realised yesterday morning that my life had peaked because I got to play a magi in a nativity and I rode a camel. I mean, come on. It doesn't get any better than that. And after that, after that Christmas moment, where better to go to on this frankly disturbingly hot weekend than to Bleak Midwinters, to the poetry of Christina Rossetti? So really, I want to do two things this afternoon, and I'm genuinely giving you permission to go to sleep. Because I have that kind of voice, particularly when I start reading poetry. So really, I'm going to read some stuff from In the Bleak Midwinter, which is a new book for Advent and Christmas, a poem a day on Christina Rossetti. And then I'm going to be really self-indulgent and read some of my own poems from my new poetry collection, A Kingdom of Love. Let's start with Rossetti. So this is just a great excuse for me to read some poems. So here we go. Morning and evening, maids heard the goblins cry, come buy our orchard fruit, come buy apples and quinces, lemons and oranges, plump unpecked cherries, melons and raspberries, bloom down cheeked peaches, swart headed mulberries, wild free-born cranberries, crab apples, dewberries, pine apples, blackberries, apricots, strawberries, all ripe together in summer weather. Morns that pass by, fair eves that fly, come by, come by. That's how I begin my book on Christina Rossetti and Advent and Christmas. Now, given that Advent is traditionally a season of repentance and prayerful discipline, you might find my use of a section of Rossetti's most voluptuous, ravishing poem, Goblin Market, as a framing device, a little bit eyebrow-raising. Rather than begin with her most famous devotional poem, from which the book takes its title, I begin with lines that show Rossetti in fantastical and secular mode for Goblin Market. Certainly her most critically acclaimed poem is a remarkable fairy story about the travails of sisters Lizzie and Laura and the temptations they face when they are offered the fruits of goblin men. So Goblin Market might seem really far from In the Bleak Midwinter, whose themes of Christmas joy and intimacy are framed in taut, restrained lines, so properly called a Christmas carol. Here's how it goes. You could almost recite it with me. In the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan. Earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. Snow had fallen, snow on snow, snow on snow, in the bleak midwinter, long ago. Our God, heaven cannot hold him, nor earth sustain. Heaven and earth shall flee away when he comes to reign. In the bleak midwinter, a stable place sufficed. The Lord God Almighty, Jesus Christ. Enough for him whom cherubim worship night and day, a breast full of milk and a manger full of hay. Enough for him whom angels fall down before, the ox and ass and camel which adore. Angels and archangels may have gathered there, cherubim and seraphim thronged the air, but only his mother, in her maiden bliss, worshipped the beloved with a kiss. What can I give him, poor as I am? If I were a shepherd, I would bring a lamb. If I were a wise man, I would do my part. Yet what I can, I give him. Give my heart. But you see, I don't think there's any great tension between starting with Rossetti's voluptuous, delightful, sensuous words, these tempting words that she uses in Goblin Market, and then seeing that as a connective tissue into her religious poetry. Because such is Rossetti's grasp of the sensuous that her poetry can be quite literally mouth-watering. Indeed, I want to go so far as to suggest that part of the power of her more obvious religious poetry, often austere, careful, discreet, is predicated on her profound understanding of the riches found in desire. Rossetti is only able to offer religious poetry of such demanding richness because she understands the depths of our desire, the sensuality of our body, of our bodies. Indeed, as many people have argued, if Goblin Market can be read as a kind of childlike fable, and Rossetti thought that that's exactly what it was, it also contains extraordinary readings of the Eucharist, of lesbian eroticism, of the power of salvation, amongst many other things. So consider this from the depths of the poem, where the shattered and fading Sister Laura, the one who was given into the goblin men's temptations, feeds on her sister's body with such intimacy through the lines of the body's juices. Now, if this doesn't, as many critics have suggested, afford a feminist reading of a female Christ figure, then heck, we might as well just pack up the tent and go home. Check this. So this is, Lizzie says this to her sister. Come and kiss me. Never mind my bruises. Hug me, kiss me, suck my juices, squeezed from goblin fruits for you, goblin pulp and goblin dew. Eat me, drink me, love me. Laura, make much of me. For your sake, I have braved the glen and had to do with goblin merchant men. Laura started from her chair, flung her arms up in the air, clutched her hair. Lizzie, Lizzie, have you tasted for my sake the fruit forbidden? Must your light like mine be hidden, your young life like mine be wasted, undone in mine undoing? And ruined in my ruin, thirsty, cankered, goblin-ridden? She clung about her sister, kissed and kissed and kissed her. Tears once again refreshed her shrunken eyes, dropping like rain after long, sultry drought, shaking with anguish, fear and pain. So Lizzie offers to her sister Laura her own body for salvation, and in her self-giving, she is not consumed by the merchant men's fruits which have drained her sister dry. You see, Rossetti gets it. She gets how desire and hunger and salvation, she gets how poetry is God's abiding language. She gets how it is all located in and through the body. She is a woman who, in her Anglo-Catholicism and her living of an increasingly ill and limited body, can experience and encounter the promises of God, the promises of the end time, the eschaton, of the kingdom of love, and how that is mediated through the body and blood of Christ. And this is where we find the ligaments, the connected tissue, the religion which binds the poetry and God and divine time and space together. For this is what I find in Rossetti's poems of faith, a radical challenge to live in and on divine time and space in resistance to commercial and capitalist time. We have to wrestle with what the critic Constance Hassett has called Rossetti's flagrant concealment and garrulous reticence. And Rossetti discreetly, deliciously invites readers into stillness, terror, new relationship. You see, Rossetti's poems reveal that we don't have to simply structure time and space according to secular pressures. Rossetti's social, cultural, and political time, of course, was one in which the mercantile, the mechanical, was the emergent king. In Victorian times, the pressure was on to make and sell things as quickly as possible. This was an age when time and space, via new technologies, was being reworked and re-experienced anew by rich and poor alike. Mass production techniques made cheapish but well-made consumer goods available to the British middle classes for the first time. And Rossetti's goblin men say, come buy, come buy. And it was echoing around middle class lives and increasingly working class lives too. Time was becoming imperial time, where department stores provided palaces in which fruits of empire, both literal and metaphorical, could be touted and tried. And Christina says, in the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan. Earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. Snow had fallen, snow on snow, snow on snow. In the bleak midwinter, long ago. It seems to me that Rossetti's decision to shift the nativity to a bleak, cold northern winter, about which more in a moment, models a melancholic, frozen environment into which not only God may enter, but effectively must enter. The environment requires God's unfreezing. At a theological level, the physical cold gestures towards the frozen and fixed realities of the human condition in need of God's transformation. Rossetti's transposition of the nativity to a frozen, bleak landscape disrupts any sentimental assumptions one might have about Christ's nativity. And so if that opening stanza establishes a kind of mise-en-scene, it is the second stanza which, in 8 short lines, taut, intense lines, offers an astounding series of theological gambits. Our God, heaven cannot hold him, nor earth sustain. Heaven and earth shall flee away when he comes to reign. In the bleak midwinter, a stable place sufficed. The Lord God Almighty, Jesus Christ. And of course, we've got this uniting, haven't we, of the first and second coming of Christ. The speaker's God not only cannot be held by heaven or sustained by earth, but shall make them flee away in the fullness of his, her reign. However, balanced against this is the claim that in the frozen human world, a stable place sufficed for God. This pun on stable clearly holds within it both the implications of the precarious, the animal stable in the fierce depths of winter, as well as implications of the steady and the safe, the way in which a stable might offer shelter. So as so often with Christina's writing, we get this paradox, a theology of poetics, which holds both and rather than either or. And I think that's the only God who's worth worship. That's the living God. Now, the Reformed theologian of hymnody, Ian Bradley, has questioned whether it is right to suggest that heaven cannot hold God, nor earth sustain. Now, of course, I mean, you know, I'm no biblical scholar. Well, ish. I'm kind of ish. But 1 Kings, there we go, 1 Kings 8:27. In Solomon's prayer of dedication for the temple, he says, "But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, the heaven and heaven of heavens cannot contain thee. How much less this house that I have builded." While that may offer a biblical warrant for Rosetta's claims, I'm more interested in her poetic ambition, her register and tone, the deceptively simple poetic constructions and the space they make for visions of God, which stretch theology to breaking point and sometimes take us beyond. And yet, just as Rosetta's theological poetics are about to break down into nonsense, she takes us down and down into the simple, the located, the personal, without ever collapsing into sentimentality. Once again, the icy, almost sublime context holds sentiment in check. For if cherubim worship him, a breastful of milk suffices. This is a scene which holds within it the possibilities of archangels. But even so, it is not so exalted that a menagerie of wild beasts shivering in the sharpness of winter, the very depths of bleakness, are excluded from offering their witness to. This is a realm of possibility balanced by the concrete. Angels and archangels may have gathered there. Cherubim and seraphim thronged the air, but only his mother, in her maiden bliss, worshipped the beloved with a kiss. So ultimately then, even if the whole host of heaven may have gathered at this site of wonder and terror and birth, it is a scene shaped by a human relationship between mother and child. Only the virgin worships through the medium of a kiss. Surely this is a kiss of adoration, which theologically counters the final kiss of betrayal from Judas, that directs Christ towards his ultimate destiny. If one places it in the wider manifesto of Mary's song, her Magnificat in Luke 1, it is also a moment of recognition and initiation. There, Mary sings of her child as the one who shall scatter the proud in the conceit of their heart, who shall put down the mighty from their thrones and exalt the lowly. He shall fill the hungry with good things and send the rich away empty. In this moment between mother and child, part of that promise is fulfilled. However, equally in this tender private moment, Mary takes up her central role as teacher, who shall initiate the human Jesus into the way that shall lead him in the Beatitudes to proclaim that the poor and the meek and the hungry are blessed. Oh, it is such a moment. A moment between mother and child. And there are all these others there worshipping. And they adore him, but Rosetta's speaker constructs this moment around the intimacy of Mary's kiss, of her maiden bliss. And for that moment, the world of men and patriarchy and power and authority conceived through all those traditional means is set aside. Mary and Christ share their peculiar strangeness together. She is mother and yet maiden. Christ is human and yet God. Together they share this kiss of blessing. It is their moment alone before the world is let in. And then we come finally to the world of hearts, to the world of the personal. What can I give him? Poor as I am. I think the poverty of this speaker represents us. We cannot offer kiss as worship much as one might long to. Yet the fact that a simple Palestinian woman can make an offering adequate to the Almighty should encourage us. Rosetti's speaker is hungry to make an offering and is tantalized by hypotheticals. If only she were a shepherd or a wise man, she would know what to do. What can she offer? My heart. You know, to speak of hearts in poetry and elsewhere, I think is pretty darn risky. I think it risks kitsch. It's all heart, it's all about heart. But I think in this context, this conclusion is correct. The heart is the metaphor without parallel. It is the quiddity of our being. You see, if the heart has become associated with soppiness and changeability, that's not Christina's fault. Perhaps it might be helpful as a corrective to think of that famous 14th century story of Saint Chiara Vengente. I don't know if you've heard this. I think this is just fantastic. I just love this, right? So here we go. She died. She was, a sister, a nun. And as she died, she insisted she had Christ in her heart. And when she died, her body resisted decay for 5 days, which is, classic. You know, we're talking classic saint territory here. And in the light of this miracle, the sisters of the convent removed her heart and placed it in a box. Now, a certain Sister Francesca decided to investigate further and cut the heart in two. Inside, she found a tiny sculpted crucifix, and alongside a panoply of miniature items associated with Christ's passion. These items were wrought from Chiara's flesh itself, and her heart is still on display in a reliquary in Montefalco. Now, if our modern sensibilities find such a story grim or ridiculous or implausible, it enacts a vision of the centrality of the heart to faith. It presents us with a vision of what it might mean for that extraordinarily significant organ to be the great gift each of us can offer to God. You know, Christmas, we all know, goodness me, it presents challenges to so many of us, doesn't it? You know, it's so complicated. I mean, goodness me, to negotiate what can be family time or the absence of family time, or the violence and the bleakness, or the expectation. It can be so challenging. And of course, you know, for people of faith as well, there is that dimension of thinking, oh, it's all just got so commercial. Not least among the challenges on offer is a question of how the arrival of God as baby can be any sort of serious gift at all. When we ask, what on earth might one's own gift to God look like in return, one finds an analogue. In the bleak midwinter constructs a series of compelling conundrums that meet those questions with mystery and wonder. The God worshipped by Christians cannot be held by heaven or sustained by earth, and yet is in the midst of nativity. A babe, helpless, unable to feed himself, unable to self-care, utterly dependent on us. He is so vulnerable that he could not defend himself if we sought to hurt him. Seemingly his only gift is to elicit our love. Our kiss, the offering of a beating, changing heart. just going to take just a beat and have a little drink something. This might be an opportunity for those of you who are thinking, I wish I'd gone to Pagoda to leave. But just give me 1 second, and then I just want to come back. And I'm going to read some poems, and then we'll open it out for a conversation. Sorry. Thank you for staying with me. I had a sense that those of you who hadn't taken this opportunity to have a nice little sleep, which was, I'm so delighted. I have this dream of reading audiobooks one day and, you know, that people fall asleep to. But for those, I just had a sense of attentiveness there. Thank you. I'm gonna read some poems from a new collection. If you are keen on getting hold of it, it's available at the bookstore. It is only available at Greenbelt until the end of September, so get in there while you can. A Kingdom of Love is a meditation on, I suppose, what it means to be a body, what it means to be a person of faith, what it means to be a body which doesn't always work well, and what it means to live in the midst of liturgy and God and technology. And what I'd like to do, if I may, and again, I'm just going to read through a whole section here, see how I get for time, and then I will maybe read one or two more, the kind of things that people think, oh, that's a poem. Certainly the kind of performance poet thing. I will do that before we open out to a conversation. So I'm going to read from this first section, which is simply called A Kingdom of Love. And it's partly in conversation with Rossetti, and it begins with two epigraphs. The first one is, "There's blood between us, love, my love," Rossetti. And then the second one is from Wittgenstein, "A poet's words can pierce us." Now, I want to invite you into what I think is a meditative space here, that poetry is a language which can make God available. And I don't want you to be sat there thinking, I need to understand everything in these poems. Poems that are written for the page, I think we have to come back to again and again and again. But I want to invite you to receive them as gift. Imagine this as the voice of a priest who is me and not me, wrestling with their identity. A Kingdom of Love. I return from the garden of remembrance. I wash the dead from my hands. I sing the versicles for evensong. O Lord, my larynx trembles with mucus and awe. Collect for purity. I try to form prayer's capital word on my tongue. O sweet imagination, give it shape enough. Love. Love should taste of something. The sea, I think, brined and unsteady. Of scale and deep, and all we crawled out from. Of first day, the spirit's debut, the frantic dove torn apart, her feathers ash on Eden. Yet of that of which we cannot speak, we must pass over in silence, Selah. The spirit itself maketh intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. Fides quarens, faith seeking understanding. Am I required to believe in the uncorruption of saints, the mother's timeless womb? There is limit, even if limit is never drawn. I cannot give an instance of every rule. I don't know what believe in means in the vast majority of cases, which is to say, I think it enough to acknowledge glamour of words, relic, body, bone. I think mystery is laid in syllables, syntax, miracle, a kind of grammar, milk to train the tongue. Ubi caritas. We learn the world, the first world of love and drool and sweet milk through lips. What surprise that prayer shares a language with kisses. The ordinal. I've lived for the feelings of others. That's a listening of sorts. What have I learnt? That self is bitumen, black as tar. Oh, how slowly we flow. Oh, how slowly we flow. We crack with age. I've lived for the feelings of others, a philosophy of sorts. I've heard self give up its final word, coughs and whispers in hospitals and nursing homes. Oh, how slowly we flow. Oh. Extreme unction. I've anointed the dying, smeared oil on the book of human skin. I've seen what we're written in, creases, scars, scabs, witnessed terminal breath. I've known the final room. Christ lies brittle on a hospital bed. Something slips free, a syllable of self, sweet trill. Deep, deep the sound goes. He sings of cross and ash. Soon it will be accomplished. He dreams of milk and drool, of bitter birth, brush of prayer on lips. He dreams of mother's kiss, secret love. My God, why have you forgotten me? Compline. Why should I not have lovers too? Which is to say, when no one else comes near, God will have to do. Prayer is the body's work, is. I was taught to steeple my fingers as a child, form a spire like this. Prayer ascends. It is naked, shiver. O God, avert thine eyes. Thine eyes are multitude. Thy tongue is bitter. Credo. I am racked by assertions. God is not a name. God is love. God is. A person without a name is not. That is one of history's truths. I have seen the films of the camps where names are erased. If God, if God is to be claimed as lover, I must multiply names. Numa, the three in one, Mother, Tetragrammaton, Al-Wajid, Bhagavan, Diabolos, Jesus. Jesus puts a tongue into my mouth. I am. A kingdom of love, too. If the world is all that is the case, if it is the totality of facts, not of things, what then of prayer? I sit in church, say authorized words, the Lord Almighty grant us a quiet night and a perfect end, amen. Say them out loud, though I'm alone. That is how it is at this hour. I make my singular witness, offer the fact of prayer, a formula and more. The compromise of centuries made valid. What matter is it if there is no God to validate? The conditions lack, prayer's a game and a fine one. Our help is in the name of the Lord, Selah. Night after night, words lock into place, a game without novelty. There is no reference point, no object grounding it beyond anticipated love. The Apocalypse of John. We gather at church door for a body, and perhaps this is creak of last day, 10 of us eyes downcast, behold a universe in pavement cracks. I hold a word in my hands, eleison. I whisper, in God, nothing is ever truly lost, but already a seal is broken, and I am sick of rain and storm and pale horse. And pale horse comes to my door, and perhaps this is last day, and rain, an angel silent in heaven, and dare I believe, in God, nothing is ever truly lost. 2. A body dies, and I sing requiem. Man hath but a short time to live. Man hath but the validity of material things. Requiem is black universe. Word is gravity. Body is praise. 3. Yet to find one's final form, surely that's the meaning of hope against hope. The ashes of a neighbor wait in my study for burial in a garden of grit and peonies and loam. Soon to be carried a final time, soon to be earthbound, a statement in ontology. Ecstatic, cool, unraveled. Corpus Christi. 1. Body crumbles into its appointed place, 2 foot by 2, powder swirls above hole's lip. I sing my words, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. We are people of unclean hands. As I pour damp afternoon into shale, my skin dark with soil and burnt bone. Take me with you, the dim day responds. Take me, priest. We understand each other. Let us thrive. 2. Body crumbles into its appointed place. I survey life everlasting from grave's lip. Witness flesh give consent to earth's forgiveness. Administration of worms and death no more. I scrape from the tub the last of self's gritted truth and walk off. Sure of nothing except soil and winter, that our end is a wreckage of heaven. A Kingdom of Love, 3. If in the resurrection I shall be raised to congregation, face to face, all eyeless skulls, so much dust, ached with near forgotten form, a finger, teeth, tongue, if so, I shall know only you. All else washed clean, virgin robes, metaphor for the begin again. If I am raised, I shall not care if you will be like unto severed hand, forgetful, free, and I the stump mourning. And if on that day, poetry shall be done with its need of hearts. I too shall walk glory bound, a kingdom of heaven. I shall sing other songs, separate and singular, joy. Thank you. I think I will stop there. If we've got time at the end, I might share a couple of much more accessible poems. But we'll take some, a time for conversation.
Okay, we're going to do our best to get the microphone to anybody who wants to ask a question. It's really important that questions are asked, if at all possible, via the question, so everybody can hear, and so that people listening on the recording later on can hear too. So do we have questions? I'm sure there are 101.
Thank you for that. The thing that really struck me was the amazing sensitivity to what was both in your work and in the work that you were reflecting on. And I'm struck by the contrast with the times that we're living in, where that sense of sensitivity, that willingness to engage with what someone else has given to us, seems to be something that in all sorts of ways we're losing and that is escaping us. And I suppose what I'm left wondering is how in the life of the church you see us holding on to that capacity to listen to someone else's voice.
Oh, goodness me. I mean, not sure. I what I loved about the session with Nadia, if any of you were there, is that she said she doesn't do Q&As, but Q&Os, questions and opinions. I just thought that was terrific. So I have some views, I think. But I want to stick very much in my response with what I hope is the patience of poetry. I think, and I speak, you know, as a bone-deep Anglican here, that one of the gifts of the Anglican tradition is that we're not theological. And I know that probably sounds, people are going, it's like, what I mean is that our theology is located in liturgy. You know, lex orandi, lex credendi. You know, as we pray, so we believe. And I think there's a kind of patience in liturgy that actually is an analogue of poetry. They read each other. And there's a thing about being formed, there's a kind of formation that comes from the patience of prayer, the patience of liturgy, the patience of poetry. Because it's never something, even when you're sat there lonely, you know, in a lonely act of prayer, so it seems, you know, as that priest in that poem is articulating, it's never just oneself. We are in the place of encounter with the divine. And we have this cloud of witnesses. And we have this inheritance that, yeah, is screwy and annoying and really irritating and patriarchal and probably needs some reformation, a new reformation potentially, but it's about the formation of human beings. You know, the thing that we so often do when we start talking about God is we say, well, there's God up there. God's so divine and God's so wonderful. And then there's us humans. And actually, I think, sufficiently reformed for all my, you know, queerness and supposed radicalism to want to say there's only ever been one human being. And that's Jesus Christ. And the rest of us are kind of approximations. And I think that's incredibly liberating to have a sense that, you know, I mean, I'm going to be really naughty now, but you asked the question. I'm going to pick on you now, sir. But, you know, you might be coded as, you know, sort of white, middle class, cis, maybe het, man. And you've often been seen as the kind of norm for what human being is. You are the human being and the rest of us are approximations. Well, actually, you know, we just have to deal with the fact that you ain't. But not because some of the rest of us are, but because Jesus Christ queers us. And actually, I think that's a humbling thing. And that humbling encounter is shaped and formed through prayer and liturgy and attention. Oh, I didn't expect a random one. Sorry.
People are spellbound. More questions, more points.
Hello. When you're responding to somebody else's poetry, do you prefer to read it or hear it, or are they completely different experiences?
That's a fantastic question. I mean, I think there are different kind of genre when it comes to poetry. I mean, so obviously the classic performance versus page poetry. I mean, I think of myself much more as a page poet. And so in that sense, I always want... And, you know, this is great marketing strategy at Poetry Festival, saying to people, can you please acquire the book before the poetry reading? So you sort of try and sell loads of copies of the book. But there is a sense in which actually being able to see the form of the poem, the shape, the intention, the kind of lines really, really helps. So there is a kind of visual, but also an aural thing as well. I mean, clearly when it comes to, you know, the wonder that is Christina Rossetti, We don't have her voice. She died in 1894. I guess she might have been recorded, but it would have been that terrible scratchy recording sound that no one would want to listen to. So we don't have her voice directly, but of course we do, because there is this location. I think it is possible for people to locate themselves in the word, just as those words escape the poet and escape the poet's attempts to determine them. So thank you for the question. Thank you.
So as a poet, when you're reading other poetry, what is it that you're looking for? Or like, what's the relationship between reading and writing in that way for you, just in terms of your practice and the ways that you think about poetry? And yeah.
Well, I guess what I'm always looking for the markers of the things that make me feel safe. Let me put it this way, because basically I think of myself as a kind of, clumsy, rather stupid sort of person. And I think that applies to a lot of academics, actually. Academics are brilliant, brilliant, brilliant people. But there's a thing about wanting to feel safe. And that thing in academia, where actually this is, you're looking for something that's really well constructed and reveals itself enough that one can participate in it. So I'm looking for the formal markers. I'm looking for the rhythm. I'm looking for rhymes, sometimes half rhymes. I'm looking for the way in which form determines what can be said, and then how I can find a way into that, but allow always the poem to elude me. Because I think that's the thing about good poetry, is that it eludes us, that it's not that it's utterly mysterious, although much of Rossetti's poetry has that character, but that it still has its integrity. Something like that.
So on the grounds that there's no such thing as a stupid question, can you give us a little more biography of Christina Rossetti, and can you tell us how her thought evolved?
Okay, no, that's. I can have a go. I can have a go. I mean, that's a good question, isn't it, though? Is there such a thing as a stupid question? I mean, yours isn't, sir. Absolutely not. But I mean, I'm going to mull that over. Rossetti was born, if memory serves, in 1830. She was the fourth child of Gabriele Rossetti, who was an Italian from the Kingdom of Naples. He fled from there with a price on his head. He ended up teaching Italian, became professor of Italian at King's College. He married the daughter, and I forget her name, maybe it's Maria. He married Maria, and Maria's the daughter of one of the Polidori clan. Now, you may have heard of Polidori. Polidori, because his son was a doctor who was Byron's doctor for a while. So she was the fourth of the children to be born. Very, very famous brother, of course, Dante Gabriel, born at the time when Rossetti Sr. was obsessed with Dante and was producing a translation. Then there is a sister who became a nun. She's the eldest. And then there's the other one, who William Frederick, who became a civil servant and the executor of Rossetti's will and poetry. Now, in terms of the development of Rossetti's thinking, Rossetti grew up in a very, very artistic household, was one of the first sitters for Dante Gabriel, and wrote a fantastic takedown of him called In an Artist's Studio. Do check out that poem. It is in the book. It's fantastic. Now, she suffered from considerable ill health early on, and I think that has had an impact on her sense of relating to the wider world. Got better, rebuffed various marriage proposals because, well, in one case, because the guy was an Anglo-Catholic who then converted to be a Roman Catholic, and she didn't want to know then, so he deconverted, if that's the correct term, and then she really didn't want to know anyway because she wasn't quite sure of him, so he reconverted back to Roman Catholicism. But she, absolute passionate Anglo-Catholic. So from, I think, sort of 1844 onwards, she started worshipping, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but a very famous Oxford Movement Church in London on Albany Street. And she was absolutely knocked out by their vicar's sermon series on the Book of Revelation. And this had a huge impact on her kind of apocalyptic readings of the Bible. Now, I also think she had the works of John Keble had a big impact on her, the great Tractarian scholar. His Christian Year, which was a book of poems, heavily annotated by Christina, and many of the poems contained in here are seasonal poems, which are so much better than Keble's poems, but are responding to the same themes. She lived for most of the century, died in 1894. She lived with Graves' disease later in life, which is something that Nadia Boltz-Weber was talking about this morning. A woman who, in so many ways, lived a quiet life, a withdrawn life, for various reasons, partly because she was caring for her mother, partly because I think she had to negotiate what it meant to be her body and its growing ill health, but also someone who lived in a profoundly interior and powerful way in one sense, but in another sense was involved in working with what would have then been called fallen women, sex workers, as we perhaps might use now, with her sister, and was involved in that early movement of women, middle-class women, engaging with emergent social issues. Is that helpful? I wasn't sort of prepped for that, but I'm just kind of... so I'm really sorry if I just wittered on then.
I think that deserves a round of applause in its own, doesn't it? It was like just a minute for 19th century poetry. It's extraordinary.
It's sort of like, yes, without repetition.
I think we have time for one more question before maybe you end with the poem.
That would be wonderful. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for your talk. I've really enjoyed it. The epigraph to the poem that you wrote, There's Blood Between Us, Brother, My Brother, can you tell me what that means and why it's inspired that poem?
Thank you. I'm not sure I can off the top of my head. If I remember rightly, is it from The Convent Threshold? God, I'm really alarmed here because there is a really serious English scholar here who actually knows some stuff about Rossetti. So I'm like going, I'm just trying to be, you know, I'm dilettante about this. I think part of it, I'm not quite sure what I can say off out of context, but I think it's that sense of, if I remember rightly, with A Convent Threshold, this is a poem written in a speaker's voice of someone who is on the threshold of transformation, of change, of stepping into a new community, but is also holding back, stepping forward, holding back, is negotiating perhaps a lost love. I could be wrong on that. Do speak to Lizzie, she'll correct me later. But that sense of being caught between, that sense of longing, and that, you know, that ambiguity, the doubled meaning, the doubledness of blood. There is blood between us, love, my love, because there is, you know, it could be bad blood, there could be heat, there could be violence, and that, and of course, blood being spilled. But that co-sanguinity, if that's the correct word, that idea of sharing blood, and of course, that's incredibly Eucharistic. If you're interested in vampires like I am, so it has that sense of intimacy, of feeding off each other, not necessarily in a positive way. Is that kind of gives some sense of what's going on there in that poem and me negotiating that relationship with the living God. Yeah.
It sounds completely like you know what you're talking about, Rachel.
I know. I'm sort of just a plausible blagger, I think.
It's far from it. So we do have time for you to read.
Thank you. So may I read a couple of shortish poems? Can I say you have been just incredible, so alert and attentive, and I will be stepping from here into the G books, I think almost immediately. And the last time I did a signing at Greenbelt, it was I started writing dedications to Tumbleweed because there were so few people. And even if you just, I mean, I'm not saying that I've got issues, but even if you've hated everything that I've written, just come and say hello. But ideally, come and say hello with a book open like this. So, a couple of poems to finish off. What should we go for? I want to take a bit of a risk here. I'm going to read a poem that was inspired by Tennyson's Idylls of the King. Bear with me. It's not, you know, some biblical, some epic here that I'm going to do. We've all been trying to avoid the B word all weekend, probably. And this is me sort of reflecting on the complexities of all that. I don't mind, hands up, you know, I am in the revoke camp, but I'm trying to hold here something richer. A sense of, in what sense can I speak England at all, because the concept of England so often is toxic and problematic. So this is a winter poem called Idylls. So imagine me on a train. South of Stoke, England in the snow. Only time I think it's safe to speak of love of country when coverage is incomplete. Green breaks through white, green, green. Youth, promise, songs of innocence. A steel windmill spins and trees are bones. I could believe in silence beyond window glass. That's snow for you. I adore its cliches. Oh, white vacuum, reach inside. Let me take my chance, speak of love of country while no one can hear or breathe. Passengers pass along the aisle. An attendant pours tea, hands me bacon in a roll. South, south, deeper into territory. This is England. Who can spot my fakery? My announcements, tannoy bright. Here, Arthur Baden stormed, Grail lost, rejoice, Boudicca, Gawain, Lud. My pronouncements, facsimiles of what? Snow becomes complete. Whiteout, England. Whiteout, England. England. And finally, a poem for the season that we kind of hope will come, but we're not sure is going to come. I mean, I'm talking here about autumn. I'm not quite convinced that we shall see its like again in this land. this is called Evensong. And it has as its epigraph a line from Thomas Traherne, who is one of England's greatest poets, a metaphysical poet, just extraordinary. And imagine a priest running to take evensong in Herefordshire, Traherne's county. Evensong. Love is a phoenix that will revive its own ashes. Thomas Traherne. September. And the orchard sags with prayer. Strip the fruit of sin, reap, reap. Why lifts lime, spins pools of silt at the tip, of fields, and it is late, late, late. O priest, hurry on. Sing, O miserable offender, within thy walls of stone. Hurry on, witness his truth. Glory is not a word. God is neither noun nor verb, but shears laden fields. He reapeth where he doth not sow. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.